I must say, Latimer, this alchemical lab is lovely. And those are such amazing flowers in the planters over there. It's so warm and fragrant in here, almost as if the place is lulling me to sleep.
Indeed, though I'd advise against sleeping, ma'am, or closing your eyes.
This place had better not be fraught with peril, or I'll get very cross.
Oh, there's no peril here, ma'am. I was just dispensing some general life advice.
Oh, I do have one question, though. Who does all this belong to?
It's not wise to say their name aloud, ma'am, but I can whisper it to you.
Oh, go on then. Oh, my.
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril.
Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't lost several days watching a video of Tom Hiddleston doing an Irish accent. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea there for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. Well, this is an interesting tea there, a sort of cross between an alchemical lab and botanical garden greenhouse. As there are so many pungent flowers down that end of the greenhouse, we'll take tea here in the lab area. So many flasks and test tubes, with all manner of colourful substances boiling within. It's quite splendid to look at. I would advise you don't touch anything, though. Goodness knows what half of this stuff is.
I'm sorry to disturb you, ma'am, but your guest has arrived. A Ms. Zen Cho.
Oh, splendid. Let's see her calling card.
That may be difficult.
You haven't lost it, have you?
Ma'am! Of course not! The very idea. Ms. Cho did not give me a card. She gave me something else instead.
Something else?
Perhaps I'd better show you.
Wait, are those ants?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, they're crawling all over the table. They're going to get everywhere.
Ew,
they're spelling out something. Oh, it says Zen Cho.
And now they're on fire.
And now they're on fire. What is going on?
Don't worry, ma'am. I'll put them out.
Yes, and we need a new tablecloth. And quickly, Latimer, we shouldn't keep Zen waiting.
Very good, ma'am.
For those of you who don't know, Zen Cho is an author and corporate lawyer. Her debut novel, Sorcerer to the Crown, was longlisted for the Tiptree Award, and Zen has just won the British Fantasy Society Best Newcomer Award 2015.
Ms. Zen Cho, ma'am.
Hello, Zen. Do come and sit down. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you doing?
Yes, not bad at all, thank you. I was wondering if you would like to have a cup of tea.
I'd love a cup of tea. What kind of tea have you got?
Well, I've got a variety of teas. When I used to invite my friends to the tea lair, I used to think, well, I'll just have an English breakfast tea or an Assam. But over the years, there have been quite a few different requests. So now we're starting to bring this very large basket of teas. So whatever you want to have, I'm sure we'll have it.
Okay, I'll have green tea, please.
Marvellous.
My default. Thank you.
And with green tea, I don't add anything to it, do I?
No, I don't have anything in it.
Marvellous. I will just leave that there. Let it steep a little bit. Would you like some millionaire shortbread?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Marvellous. And I'll pour. I hope you don't mind the chickens over there. You're not allergic to chickens or feathers or anything, are you?
No, I love chickens.
Marvellous. Excellent. So, in my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you. I was wondering what you've brought with you today.
I'm terribly sorry about this. I hope you don't take it the wrong way, because it's just occurred to me that it might be kind of rude. But being Malaysian, I'm basically obsessed with food, and I'm constantly worried that I'm not going to have enough of it. So I brought some food, but I'll share it with you if you're into this kind of food. It's nasi lemak. It's kind of the Malaysian national dish, and as you can see, it's very nicely wrapped in a kind of pyramidal shape.
Yes.
In banana leaf, and if we open it up, which I will try to do without dropping any rice on the floor, you'll see it's rice cooked in coconut milk with the sambal, that's a sort of shrimpy chili paste that makes everything taste better, some fried anchovies, peanuts, raw cucumbers, a hard-boiled egg, and curry. I don't really know why I thought I should bring this on my interdimensional trip to an alchemical lab, but I thought just in case, you know, if you were hungry and felt like something more than cake.
It's not rude at all. I'm quite thrilled. I don't often have people bringing food. You know, usually the pressure is on me to provide the cake. So this is fantastic. We have savoury and sweet. So Exactly. Marvellous. Thank you. I've never tried these before. That's fantastic. Oh, yes. Very tasty. So, I wanted to ask you a question regarding law, because I was thinking about this as I was making a cup of tea yesterday, in fact, that the language of the law is not understood by the vast majority of people. It's very complex and it can be wielded to great effect. It can give people a lot of power. And I was wondering if being a corporate lawyer sometimes makes you feel like you're a mage.
That's a fantastic question. I think if you ask most lawyers, it's very rare that they feel that they have anywhere as much power as one imagines a mage to have. I was speaking to a friend once who wanted to come and visit my firm, but was a bit apprehensive about it. And I said, and she's a geek, as many of my friends are. And I said to her, well, to be honest, most lawyers are sort of stressed introverts who like books better than people. So it's quite like going to a convention, except everyone's a lot less happy. Which, you know, I know I wasn't really selling it to her, but I guess hopefully help her feel more relaxed, you know, and not sort of intimidated. I think feeling like a mage, I think it's interesting the kind of idea about the language of the law having this inherent power. And I suppose that's true, isn't it? The language of the law as a tool of magic. I've never really seen it like that, mostly because the law is so boring. I've often thought about the parallel between being a lawyer and being a writer and a fan of genre, because if you're a lawyer in the UK or many other common law countries, you have, you know, two sources of law, and one is what's written down in the books, I guess, these imaginary books where the legislation lives, and one is what judges say when they decide in cases. Each case is really a story, you know, and the judge, if you will, is the mage who kind of decides what the ending is. He's the storyteller. Mm. And I've always sort of seen a parallel between that and genre SFF, because with SFF you have a body of work that sort of is the history of our genre and sets the kind of, I don't know, the context for the stories that we tell now. And of course, society as a whole also sets the context and so on. But having this delimited set of books and stories that most people who are reading know and they refer to, I feel that's quite similar to being a lawyer who's working, and you're working in this context where you've got, you know, all these cases to refer to. It's not a very clear articulation of this idea, but essentially, I think judges are mages. Lawyers are basically stressed introverts. Like books better than people.
I think that is a really interesting parallel, because when you're outside of the world of law, like myself, obviously, as a complete layman when it comes to the law, my only interaction with it would be through a lawyer. And the only lawyers I've ever interacted with have been the kind of the minor ones that deal with house and buying and selling, nothing more scary than that. But the things that I've heard my friends and my family talk about where they've had more interaction, it's such a terrifying thing. And then this lawyer comes along who knows all the right words and the way to do it and the way to work this magic. But I find it fascinating that you on the inside see it very differently. And that in itself reminds me of when you're an aspiring to be published writer and then you become a writer, and that the experience of being inside the industry is so different from your perception before being inside the industry as well. So I wonder if that is like the universal thing here, that as soon as you know something very, very well, it loses its magic, perhaps.
That's probably right. Yeah, no, that's an interesting parallel.
And I've never thought about judges like that either. Now I'm even more scared of them. I hope I never have to be exposed to their magic. That would be really scary. Now, a couple of years ago, I went to your reading at Nine Worlds, which I enjoyed immensely. I was right at the back. And I was struck by something that made me laugh a great deal at the time, as you were saying how you'd got there in a rush because you'd been so into this fanfic you'd been writing. And I just immediately fell in love with you a tiny bit, I have to admit. And I was wondering, what is your fanfic universe of choice? Do you have like one that you go to when you need to escape, or are there many that you play in?
No, I don't just have one. Was that Nine Worlds 2014?
I don't know, it might have been, because all of my years are blurring into one now that I've hit 40. I can't remember anything. It might have been 2 years ago. It might well have been.
I'm just trying to cast my mind back. I suspect there was one reading where I was shockingly late. But part, half because of fanfic, but half also because I decided to take a nap just before my
That
reading.
Was it, yes!
I don't really know why I thought it was a good idea, except it was, you know, it was 9:45 at night, and it'd been a long day at the con, and I'd just taken a shower, and which I always do every night before I go to bed, so, you know, clearly this kind of Pavlovian instinct rose in me, drawing me to the bed. And then I woke up and rushed to my reading, and it was completely disorganized. But back to fanfic. So it was a very indulgent evening. With fanfic, I hadn't written it in a long time, actually, because I found that once I started writing original fiction, so my own stories that I made up completely, more or less, I didn't have that much spare creative energy for fanfic. But for some reason, I'd had a resurgence that particular year. That was actually for the Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell TV adaptation.
Oh, love that so much.
Which I loved. And I loved the book as well. And it was quite funny. And I sort of justified it to myself when I was writing fanfic, when I should have been working and stuff that was under contract, was to say, it's really, because my novels are set during the Regency period, as Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell are. So the way I sort of justified it to myself was to say, well, that's fine. I'm basically practicing. Practicing for the book. You know, this is it's really good for me. It's good for my book. It's good for my book that I'm not working on it. I'm working something completely different. I used to write a lot more fanfic in lots of different fandoms, as we call them. You know, when I was a teenager, I spent years doing it, and long before, you know, before I started writing original fiction. And it ranged from things like Discworld. I used to write Discworld fanfic, to, you know, manga, anime, TV shows, really sort of anything. You know, anything where you watch it, you read it, and you think, oh, I'd quite like more of that. And then you find out, well, I can just make it up myself, or get some, you know, get a friend to make it up for me.
Yeah, yeah. I'm quite relieved that you said that you don't write as much now, because I remember thinking at the time, bloody hell, how is she able to write fanfic at the same time as getting books published? Because it does come from the same well, doesn't it? It's all the same kind of
it's similar,
store.
Yeah. But you know how you're saying, it's interesting you say that, because you know how you're saying how the publishing industry looks different when as an aspiring author versus a published author, and you know the kind of difference between seeing something from the outside and seeing it from the inside. Because you know, if you were to ask me, I'd say, oof, Emma does this podcast, and she does all these books, and she, you know, and she does this kind of LARPing stuff as well. I mean, how does she manage all that stuff, you know? And I think she's got a kid. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, I'm really tired. yeah, pathologically sleep deprived. Yeah, I love fanfic. It makes me very happy, and it makes me sad that I don't have the mental room to do that anymore. Mine was Star Trek Next Generation fanfic again when I was a teenager, just like you. And I think it gives us so much. It's such a great kind of training ground, isn't it?
It is, and I think it locks into, I don't know if about you, but it locks into a different, almost a different part of, a connected, but a different part of my brain when I'm writing. It's sort of a different experience. But I'm sure a lot of it is for me at least, is that the stakes are so much lower. I don't feel stressed about it at all. It's purely pleasure, and it's purely whatever I want to do, and I just don't care if it's any good.
Yeah.
And that's incredibly freeing. I don't know if that was your experience writing fiction.
Yeah, totally. And of course, it's only like a portion of what you do when it's your own stuff, isn't it? Because you don't have to worry about the world building, you don't have to worry about inventing you know, a core cast of characters, because if you're playing with the characters that exist already, they're already there. And so in my mind, it's kind of like when you're a kid and you're playing with action figures and you're kind of moving them around and telling your stories with them and saying what they're saying, but you're just writing it down instead. I totally agree with the whole reduction of stakes thing when it's your own thing, especially when you're under contract and there's this constant fear of, oh God, will this be okay? Is it any good? Will my editor like it, or will it get thrown back to me with rewrites and all of that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
And it, when it's just that satisfying the pleasure bit of your brain, yeah, it's a completely different experience. Oh, I'm hankering for it now, but I really don't have time for that. not even slightly. So I'd like you to imagine that you have just saved the world from the catastrophic effects of a giant volcano that would have plunged us into the most appalling winters and killed practically everybody. But you saved the world, and all of the leaders of the world have come together to thank you and to ask what you would like as a reward. What would you ask for and why?
Sorry, I'm mostly just really impressed by myself that I've managed to, you know, disarm this volcano, because I don't think I'm not a very practical person, so I don't really know how I managed that.
That's all in backstory. That's backstory. This is where the novel is starting.
What would I ask for from all the leaders of the world? I've just really, all my answers are just going to be really boringly pragmatic. So either the selfish one, which is a pension essentially until I die, an annuity, you know, and also a house. I think that those are kind of two things I'd ask for if it's being purely selfish. Or I suppose the kind of more altruistic but extremely pragmatic thing, which is a sort of, I think, a global agreement not to be shit anymore. Which would have lots of clauses and you know would take a lot of thought. I think I probably have to say to the world leaders that you all have to agree to this treaty and abide by this treaty that I'm going to draw up, but then I'd have to retreat for about 3 years while I drew it up. Yeah, it would have all the usual sort of things, sort of stuff to combat poverty, education, yeah. You know, funding the arts, all that sort of thing. I would also get rid of national borders, which people seem really shocked about when I suggest it. But
they cause so much trouble.
I suppose they wouldn't. Getting rid of them wouldn't solve the trouble, but it's sort of tempting to think it might help. Also, one of the things, if I was queen of the world, which I know I'm not in this scenario, but is kind of equivalent, if you know, thinking about what you'd do if you could tell everyone to do what to do, is I've said before that I'd sort of require everyone to learn three languages, which a lot of people again find a bit tough, and I've not really successfully done that myself, but I just sort of think in theory it'd be good for everybody.
You know, I couldn't agree more, because I used to specialise in languages, but I only did European languages because that was only what was available at school. But I did French, Spanish and English. And even though they are incredibly closely related, the differences and the similarities between the languages give you so much insight, which is so thrilling.
Yeah, and I think having that access to a different linguistic culture is just, you know, it's just good for people, I think. Being English-speaking, and I include myself in that, you kind of end up in a position where you think all that you know is all that there is to know, yeah. Or, you know, all the books that you can read are all the books that there are, for example. And that's obviously not right at all. And I think being limited in language means that you can't, there's a lot of perspectives that you miss out on, which I think is generally not a great thing. So basically, my answer to the question is a very sort of complicated global treaty, which I will start drafting right away. That's a great idea. I've just given myself a load of work.
Well, you know, you wouldn't want to think that you had any spare time or anything. Yeah, no, I totally agree. Very similar to what I would hope to do myself. So there are so many reboots, remakes around at the moment, and in our creative circles it's a really common lament that there are so many books that would make brilliant films that are original but are overlooked. So which book would you make into a film if you had the power and the funds to do so?
I would really like, and I know there have been a couple of Diana Wynne Jones adaptations, but I would really like a Diana Wynne Jones movie. So I guess there was Howl's Moving Castle, wasn't there? It was that Miyazaki film. Mm-hmm. And I think Archer's Goon was made into a TV series. One of the Crestomancy books would be good, or the Crestomancy series would be good. I'd love a TV series based on that. The sort of core books, and then you'd sort of, I suppose you could do all of them, and then you'd start with focusing on him and then have him turn up. Or you could do it the other way around, which is to have him turn up and be this kind of mysterious, magical character, and then have those the lives of Christopher Chant and Charm life kind of more directly about him and the kind of characters around him.
Mm, that sounds cool. Do you know who you'd want to play him?
No, I'm really rubbish at those kinds of
things. Yeah, me too.
Do you ever cast your own characters, for example? People ask authors quite a lot, who would you like to play your characters? I never have any idea.
Yeah, I have exactly the same problem, but I also have the same problem of they are all either Tom Hiddleston or Idris Elba in my head because because they kind of satisfy all of my action needs.
Even the children.
Yeah, that's true. No, Eva Green, Tom Hiddleston, Idris Elba, and you know, I would just be so happy. In fact, I would just, you know, write something just for them. I'm going to my happy place now. So that's the problem I have, is that they always just pop up and it's like, well, I can't actually, there are billions of actors and actresses that I love and I just forget. It's like when someone says, what's your favourite book? And then I forget every single book I've ever read in my entire life. I'm just rubbish at that kind of question.
The Bible.
Yeah, it's just, I can't remember. And then, you know, it's just horribly embarrassing. So yeah, the casting questions. And sometimes I have author friends asking me to cast their books, and I don't visualize people in that way. And when my husband and I go out, when we walk through a town, I only look at the buildings, I only look at the spatial stuff. So I will say, oh, did you see that gargoyle? Did you see that facade? Oh, that's really interesting architecture. But he doesn't see any of that. He only sees the people. And so he'll say, did you see that person? What were they doing? And wow, his hair is amazing. Or what is that coat over there? And I'll be like, there are people here. And he'll be like, there was a building there. So between us, we, you know, form quite a detailed view of the world.
You could recreate the scene between the two of you.
Yes, but each of us alone are rubbish in certain areas. So yeah, and I'm not, my people gap is the problem with the casting side, definitely. So whenever I have a friend in the tea lair, I always ask on the Twitters if anyone has a question that they would like to ask if they were able to take tea with us. And Minica, who is such a lovely person, has asked, if it was possible to literally travel into a book, which of your stories would you like to visit?
I saw that. And again, I was thinking about the various settings of the stories I've written and had published. I wouldn't travel to the setting of Sorcerer to the Crown, which is my novel, and that's because it's set in 1800s London, which with magic, so it's a bit different from actual 1800s London, but it's not so different that it wouldn't be quite an uncomfortable place for me, I don't think. I wouldn't go there. I would probably boringly go to the setting of many of my short stories in my short story collection Spirits Abroad, which is Malaysia. I just go there, you know, it would be a free trip, I guess.
Yeah, there is a big difference between writing a world and then actually wanting to go to it, isn't there? massive difference.
I haven't really written secondary worlds. A lot of my stories are set in, you know, our world, but with maybe one or two key differences. Mm-hmm. So, which I think makes it a little bit more boring in terms of, you know, taking a trip there. Yeah. But yeah, so that's my answer.
Cool. One of our patrons, Paul, who is absolutely lovely as well, he really loves your chemistry punning geeky Twitter handle. And he was wondering what inspired you to, because he said in chemistry notation, it's obviously Cho. So yeah. He understands where it comes from, which is, you know, I suddenly went, oh my God, that's so clever. So thanks, Paul. So have you got a chemistry background, or was there a particular reason why you picked that one?
Well, I haven't got any more of a chemistry background than doing it at secondary school. So I studied chemistry at secondary school and also at A-level. And that, it was literally a sort of, I'm really bored in in chemistry class. And, you know, I'll just sort of mess around with things and say, like, oh, hey, aldehydes, you know, spell CHO, so that's great. So let's go with that. And ketones are also carbon, hydrogen, oxygen. So my sister's name is Rin, and her Skype handle is Rin Ketone.
I love that so much. It's like the purest geekiness kind of distilled into perfect form. I love it. If you were to choose a theme tune of your life, what would you choose? Because the chickens over there, they look perfectly normal, but they've got a very specific talent where they can sing songs. So I always like to ask for the theme tune of your life so that I can see if they can sing that song for us. So which song would you choose?
Well, I don't know if the chickens know this one, but it's Katamari and the Swing, which is the We Heart Katamari theme song. Have you ever played Katamari Damacy?
Hang on, tell me a little bit about it.
It's a Japanese game. It's quite old now. It sort of came out, I don't even know, maybe 10 years ago. And it was a PS2, PS3 game. Its basic premise is that you, the character you play, is the prince, and you're the son of the king of all cosmos, who's destroyed all the stars in the sky, I think, is the first game, and then he kind of does it again in the second game and the third game. And in order to fix it, you have to roll up big Katamari balls of stuff, which means everything around you, including, like, the Eiffel Tower or, like, a piece of cake, you know, anything. And then when you've rolled that up, you bounce it into the sky, and then your father, the king of all cosmos, shoots it to pieces with his laser eyes, and then they turn into stars.
Yes, and I have played that, and the reason why I wasn't sure is because I was in the first trimester of my pregnancy.
That explains it all, yeah.
I was so tired, I thought I was going to die. I went round to my friend Dan's house, and he said, I've got this amazing game. It doesn't matter how tired you are, you can sit and play this. And it was the most surreal gaming experience I've ever had in my life. And when he was saying, I was thinking, is it that game? Did I even play that game? Was that a real thing? I'm so glad to know it was.
I love it. I mean, as you say, the gameplay is actually quite soothing, because all you're doing is just rolling, basically.
Yeah.
There's no conflict. But what it is that the interest comes from the music and the graphics, and that's completely mad. And I've always felt that if I could get someone to design my life, the guy who could design that game would be the designer of my life. So Katamari on the Swing is my theme song.
So Katamari on the Swing. Little chickens, could you sing that for Zen, please? Do you know that one? There they go. They know game theme tunes as well.
Really impressed by that. I'm really impressed by that. Thank you, chickens.
That's brilliant. I'm going to have to think of some other game things that I want them to play now. I better not let Peter know, because he'll be getting them to sing like everything in Mass Effect ever. And wasn't it in that game as well, where if you rolled over people, they like carried on wriggling when they were in the ball?
Yeah, they'd sort of scream a bit.
Yeah, that was slightly disturbing, but cute. So what can readers look forward to next? The sequel to Sorcerer to the Crown, maybe?
Yeah, so Sorcerer to the Crown is out in paperback now, which is very exciting. And then I'm working on the second book still. It's getting towards the end, but you know when you get close enough to the end where it just stays in the distance. You keep going. I mean, I turned it in. It will hopefully come out next year. And then after that, there'll be a third book in the trilogy. So more details on my website and my various bits of social media when it happens.
Fantastic. Minika also asked if you're planning to write more in the Terracotta Bride setting. Do you have any plans to do that?
It's the setting of Terracotta Bride. That's a novelette that I self-published. Is actually a version of the Chinese Hell. So I weirdly, for someone who's quite sort of cheerful in general, I write a lot about death and hell, so that will be coming up again. I don't think I'll be writing in that particular universe of Terracotta Bride, but the setting, insofar as it's, you know, the Chinese underworld, that will be recurring in the future.
But you know, I wonder if writing about death and horrible things does make us cheerier, because all of my goth friends at university were the happiest, fluffiest, loveliest people. And I wonder if it's just, you know, if you embrace that and, you know, you have an outlet for that, then you can be kind of happier and cheerier elsewhere in your life, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. I think for me, the reason why I do it is because I don't feel scared of death, but I probably am. And it's probably my way of trying to cope with it, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I've been trying to cope with that, hitting 40 this year. Suddenly it's like, wow, I am scared of that. Yeah, yeah. Oh, now I'm going to move away from that thought very rapidly and check the teapot. And oh, I'm afraid the teapot is empty. So all that leaves for me to say is thank you so much for taking time out of your writing and corporate lawyering superheroing to come and join me for tea today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the tea and the cake.
Thank you. And thank you for bringing savoury snacky s'mores. Yay.
I'm glad you finished it.
I did. Could you tell me the name again?
Nasi lemak, Nasilemak, which basically means coconut milk rice, I guess is kind of the translation.
Awesome.
It's hard to translate directly.
Thank you. I will have to go and find those elsewhere. So all you need to do is, there are several doors out of this lab. I'm sure Latimer will know which is the right one to take you back down to the car. So take care, and hopefully I will see you at a convention at some point in the near future.
Thank you very much. I'm sure I'll see you soon.
Take care now. Bye.
Bye.
This way, Mum.
That was nice. Oh, it looks like Zen stopped to admire one of the flowers. Are you sure that's safe?
I'm absolutely certain, Mum.
Oh, good.
That it is not safe.
Oh, dear.
But this is an opportunity, Mum. Very few people have seen the way, having lured her close with its soporific pheromones, that this flower opens its petals to reveal its flesh-shredding teeth.
You're like a grimdark version of David Attenborough. Anyway, what are we going to do? Is that plant going to eat her?
Oh, indeed, Mum. Oh, look. Miss Cho is obliging it by kindly stepping out of her own skin.
What? Oh my god.
Ah, how clever. By revealing her true form as a rotting ghoul, she's no longer seen as food by the plant.
She has so many legs.
Eyes on the back of her head, 8 legs, giant teeth. I think I may have found my new favourite author. Goodbye, Miss Cho. Goodbye. Do come again. Mum? Mum? Oh dear. While I find the smelling salts, I would like to inform you all that the husband's short story is not called The Hammer and the Goat, and it is not available for pre-order, nor will it ever be. Do not under any circumstances buy it or say nice things to him about it. He really is bad enough as it is, and that Morningstar award certainly hasn't helped. Now, I'd better think about the next tea layer. Somewhere incompatible with human life, I think. Very good, Mum.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman and co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes, and www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.